case of the day. Starting on verses to go here. Gingras.
Thank you. Good morning. This case obviously involved a de novo review. The district court was obligated to consider the evidence, review all the facts, draw all the reasonable inferences in favor of Mr. Steinhauer. It is our position that Mr. Steinhauer is deserving of a reversal in this case and a jury trial. There was strong evidence in the record of intentional discrimination. The defendant, DeGallier, told Rebecca Kemp, and I quote, that it was her intent to turn around the male power structure at the WCC so that females would control the organization. Similarly, the defendant, according to Mr. Steinhauer, told him that this was her intent. This type of evidence is rare in employment discrimination cases. It constitutes direct evidence of discriminatory motive. In our brief, we argued that the district court did not apply the reasonable inference procedure as it should. As to this specific evidence, it's even worse. The district court completely disregarded it. If the court would look during its review to page 17 of the court's brief or opinion, where it phrased plaintiff's discriminatory evidence as a laundry list. But in that laundry list and in its discussion, it never addressed these direct statements of the defendant's strong intent to replace males with females. This is error. It is not coincidental that basically any male with any possible influence in that small agency was replaced or forced to leave. Larry Corsi, the head of projects leaders, the coordinator, was subjected to horrendous treatment, was a capable, competent employee, and left. He could not take it anymore. Mr. Steinhauer, again, responsible for training and recruitment of new core members in the human relations area, a position of influence, was suddenly terminated in December, and I will discuss that issue in a moment. But this was not the only evidence. We obtained mountains, I think, of evidence suggesting gender animus. Now, the district court is correct when you have a certain fact that is isolated, for example, the offensive jokes in the newsletters. If that were the only fact, and the testimony was such that she was attempting to be humorous, that's one thing. But when we have this entire atmosphere of anti-male animus, and it comes out even in the newsletter depicting males in a derogatory fashion, that's another thing. Even the defendant admitted under oath that she referred to the male power structure at WCC. What is the head of a state agency doing referring to a power structure by gender?
Telling the truth is always an option.
But even if it were the truth, even if males were competent and in that power structure, rightfully so, it's improper. At least there's a reasonable inference that it's an illegal motive. There was not just one witness that came forward here. There were numerous witnesses from every level of the organization that commented in one way or another as to this woman's dislike for men, hatred for men. And I won't repeat it all. It's in our brief. I'm sure the court is aware of it. But there were a couple of examples that I thought were telling. She told one employee that men are silly and not as smart as women. All we have to do is manipulate them, and we will have control over them. She even went so far as to tell the same employee that if this employee wanted to win the custody of her children, she should lie to the judge and accuse her husband of molesting her children.
Was that based on her personal experience?
I hope not.
Well, see, that was a big deal.
That may have been.
All three of these women were divorced, and they were acting back and forth about their ex's husband. So
that may be true.
I don't know what all this.
It's hard to.
Has to do with your guy. But
it's hard to understand why these types of statements are being made in the workplace. And this type of statement that she made is not unlike what she did to Mr. Steinhauer in the Personnel Commission. She approved the documents, their position statement to the Personnel Commission in this case, the investigatory agency, that said that Mr. Steinhauer sexually harassed Ms. Purifoy. Mr. Gallier recanted that under oath in her deposition. It never happened.
That this is the so-called the alleged victim recanted, or what?
No, Mr. Gallier accused Mr. Steinhauer of sexually harassing this female employee, and Mr. Gallier, under oath, in response to my questions, recanted and said that's not true. I think that's strong evidence of pretext, that the defendant is making up reasons to cover up her discriminatory discharge of the plaintiff.
Is there some distinction here? Because there seems to be other allegations of his harassing that had little to do with sexual harassment, but just being a pain in the neck, looking over shoulders and doing different, nosing into other people's business and that sort of thing.
That Mr. Steinhauer was doing that?
Yeah.
And we produced evidence from those alleged people that complained that that was not the case. For example, Ms. Purifoy, who the defendant had complained about Mr. Steinhauer about 20 times, testified under oath she never complained about Mr. Steinhauer, that she got along fine with Mr. Steinhauer. In fact, in the critical meeting in early December, she asked Mr. Steinhauer to help her fill out an application for dental insurance. And the defendant was told that, and yet used that as a basis to terminate.
Well, that was because of he said don't talk individually or privately with other people, and she asked him to do something unrelated to the job.
Actually, the December 1 memo only tells or directs Mr. Steinhauer not to seek confidential information from employees. It does not, if you look at that memo, it does not say don't meet with employees one-on-one ever. I mean, he, after all, was a part of the human resources staff. At times he would have to talk to employees one-on-one about human resource personnel issues if he was to do his job. So I think if the court looks carefully at the content of that memo, it's not all that all-encompassing. I want to talk briefly about the Desert Palace case, the new Supreme Court case. And we submitted that case pursuant to the court's procedure. That case, of course, now does say that the plaintiff in a case like this, a mixed motive case, does not have to produce evidence, direct evidence of discrimination. It can rely purely on circumstantial evidence, purely on the unworthy of credence type argument. Here, I submit to the court that we have gone above the current requirement in these types of cases. We have produced evidence of direct animus, of direct intentional discrimination. like to talk briefly about the indirect method analysis utilized by the district court, going right to the fourth prong, similarly situated employees. This court has said in Belavevar, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, that you can't the district court can't apply that prong in a rigid fashion. I think the district court did that here. He had, according to the defense, he had two employees with the same directive who apparently both violated that directive, according to their perspective, and yet they fired Mr. Steinhauer, and they don't even reprimand the female employee involved, Ms. Pierrefort.
This is that same discussion you were referring to?
Yes.
Insurance or something?
Yes. And the court makes a big distinction about probationary versus permanent employees. The case she relies on from other circuits or districts involved permanent employees that had a different collective bargaining disciplinary process. Here, that was not the case. The undisputed evidence is the disciplinary process for both was the same. So I think that distinction is misplaced in this case, and the fourth prong is satisfied at the summary judgment level, certainly. Finally, and I'm going to save about 3 minutes for rebuttal, I want to mention just pretext briefly and job performance. It wasn't mentioned by the district court or discussed in her opinion. We have the late email from Ms. Stevens saying that in October, saying that Mr. Steinhauer's performance is glowing, and it's in our brief. In early November, Ms. DeGale is praising his performance. And within 3 to 4 weeks, he's gone, just before he's about to become a permanent employee. That is suspicious timing. Suspicious timing is probative as circumstantial evidence of pretext. We have her telling the Personnel Commission about sexual harassment. Their reliance on Pierrefort and Decker is not truthful. Both witnesses came forward and said they never had a problem with Steinhauer, and that's their main reliance. They admitted they didn't follow their own disciplinary procedures. No fair and objective investigation. They have to acquire substantial evidence, not just rumor, before firing someone. They didn't even talk to Steinhauer before they fired him. And they have to follow progressive discipline. There was no suspension here. Nothing before immediate termination. They had to get him before he became permanent. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gingras. Mr. Sweeney.
Morning, Your Honors. It pleases the Court. My name is John Sweeney, Assistant Attorney General for the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And I represent the defendants in this particular case, in which Judge Crabb did a very thorough analysis of the evidence presented by both parties and issued summary judgment for the defendant. I will suggest initially that probably the main problem with the plaintiff's case, other than there is no case, has to do with the way he responded to summary judgment. As you know, once a statement is made, the plaintiff, the non-moving party, must respond. By way of example, the plaintiff is contesting the information that Ms. Stevens and Ms. DeGaglia received regarding whether or not Mr. Steinhauer was in fact harassing him, whether he was looking over her shoulder, and whether he was making her feel uncomfortable. In the proposed findings of fact, our findings of fact were Ms. Decker told Ms. Stevens, Ms. Decker told Ms. DeGaglia, or Ms. DeGaglia learned, or Ms. Stevens learned, that Ms. Decker was complaining about harassment. What the plaintiff did in response was to say, I never harassed her. Instead of saying, and instead of addressing what Ms. Decker did or didn't say to Ms. DeGaglia and to Ms. Stevens. And that's a very, very basic problem with the plaintiff's response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. Judge Crabb clearly found that there was no evidence direct evidence of discrimination. Judge Palm has recently written in a case in which he found it was frivolous, the claim that there was direct evidence of discrimination. I would suggest to you this case borders on that opinion in Leapforth, I believe, which recently came out. Secondly, Judge Crabb found that there was no circumstantial evidence of gender discrimination because the plaintiff did not link all these stray remarks that were out there, either in time or connected in any way to the defendant's termination. Judge Crabb went out of her way to indicate that the defendant's responses and proposed findings of fact, in many cases, were twisted as to what was really in the record or very seriously lacked a proper foundation. In her opinion, Judge Crabb gave a great deal of credit to many of the things that were probably inadmissible, but she indicated to the plaintiff that very often his responses lacked a proper foundation. In other words, whether or not Ms. DeGallier said X, Y, and Z 2 years ago, whether it's relevant or not, doesn't have the proper foundation to be admitted. And she wisely excluded it. I'd like to touch on a couple of the things. Obviously, the similarly situated issue is something that's important. In this case, Judge Crabb relied on the opinion from this court in Radu, in which two of you judges were participating, and
you
said,
you know, counsel, it doesn't matter who is on the panel in particular cases.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Then why do you keep repeating?
I apologize. The district court did rely on Radu, saying that it is important in all essential elements that the similarly situated element be considered. And I think the record is very clear that Ms. Purfoy, who also met one-on-one with the plaintiff, was in a very different position. She was a program assistant as opposed to a personnel assistant. And the main difference is she was not a probationary employee. And she was not the one about whom complaints had previously been received by Ms. Stevens and Ms. DeGallier. I'd like to address what my friend Mr. Jingras talked about in terms of the disciplinary proceedings. There's nothing in the record to state that the disciplinary proceedings for a full-time non-probationary employee are the same as those for a probationary employee. And secondly, and I think most importantly, the record is undisputed that Ms. DeGallier, during her term as executive director, terminated 4 employees who were on probation. And the record is very clear and undisputed that 3 of those were females. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that those females were treated any differently, or any females were treated any differently in the disciplinary process.
Is there anything in the record that whatever these negative comments about men and discussions and this sort of thing, is any of that in the context of a discussion with Mr. Steinhauer, or are these all general observations?
As I recall, Your Honor, all of the remarks were made to persons not about Mr. Steinhauer in any way, and I believe Mr. Jingras did mention one or more remarks that were made to Mr. Steinhauer, but none of them had anything to do with Mr. Steinhauer.
But there was this banter, nevertheless.
Allegedly. And as the record before you, as it was before the district court, says that those remarks actually did take place, although Ms. DeGallier, of course, denied that many of those did take place.
And these jokes and these other things, yeah.
Well, the jokes are regarding fishing and beer, and there were also quotations from men, from Martin Luther King to many other notable males. Other persons, attorneys, doctors, police officers were made the, bore the brunt of some type of humor
Well, the reason I just point that out is because these opinions should easily be inverted. This happens to be, this is unusual at this point, although it's probably going to be less unusual as time goes on. That it could be flipped over, and if this were a woman complaining about men, the same principles would apply.
They would. The same principles do apply, regardless of which gender, whether it's race or national origin, or which type of protected category we're talking about. I would like to address one thing that Mr. Gingras mentioned regarding the so-called male power structure, and there were references to the Good Old Boys Club in that particular agency, and frankly, when Ms. DeGallier arrived there, it had and was considered a Good Old Boys Club, which is not evidence of, in and of itself, of discrimination. But there's allegations that she wanted to remove the men from the project team. Mr. Steinhauer was not, contrary to the plaintiff's contention, a member of the projects team. That matter was not brought before the district court, which is why we didn't address it in the district court. Mr. Steinhauer, at pages 29 and 30 of his initial brief and pages 8 and 9 of his reply brief to this court, makes the allegation that Mr. Steinhauer was a member of the projects team, and he was not. There's nothing in the record, and in fact, he was not a member of that particular group in the agency, which is sometimes had been referred to as the power structure at the Wisconsin Conservation Corps. It is clear, based on the record before Judge Crabb, that there was no one similarly situated to Mr. Steinhauer. Judge Crabb does make the distinction, and I think it's appropriate. He was a probationary employee, Ms. Purifoy, who also met one-on-one, behind an open door, if you will. But Mr. Steinhauer was the one who had been warned about that particular behavior. Speaking of an issue that Judge Crabb did not address, job performance. Because of her ruling on the similarly situated issue, she did not address that. But I think the record is also clear that Ms. Stevens, who was the personnel director, went to Ms. DeGallier in November and said, I can't work with the man. He's insubordinate. Insubordination is an adequate, non-discriminatory reason for termination. And based on Ms. Stevens' recommendation to Ms. DeGallier, his probationary status, his employment, was terminated. And we've indicated in our brief that Mr. Steinhauer has admitted during his deposition that Ms. Stevens, the personnel director, treated him fairly all throughout his employment. And therefore, he apparently has no complaint, had no complaint against Ms. Stevens, and I think then is at a loss to challenge any of her recommendations to Ms. DeGallier, which Ms. DeGallier very obviously followed. And unless the court has further questions, I will respectfully ask that Judge Crabb's decision granting summary judgment for the defendant be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Gingras. And of course, we'll be brief. Mr. Sweeney said something interesting about Judge Crabb or the district court's treatment of this case. And he said it wasn't admitted into evidence. And I think that's a problem that is apparent throughout the opinion, is that she is very stringent on the plaintiff at this stage of the proceedings in every respect, in terms of the type of proof that's required, whether a witness said this actually, the specific words, or just remembered it in general. That's not the appropriate time for that type of exclusion. This is the summary judgment phase. Maybe at trial, if a witness can't come forward and lay the exact proper foundation, that's another issue. But that was the tenor of the whole opinion. My other point...
I'm not sure I understand this. Rule 56 says the evidence has to be admissible.
I understand. And in the context of
of summary judgment. You can't, in an affidavit, lay every possible foundation that you can anticipate the court looking at. You don't have, for example, a trial, if there's an objection as a foundation, you have a chance to cure. And you only have certain, so many page limits, and there was so much proof in this case, we couldn't, you know, get everything within the frame of our pleading. But another example is the way the court looked at the inferences. She concluded that Ms. Stevens was unsatisfied with Mr. Steinhauer's response to her verbal reprimand. Mr. Steinhauer disputed he ever got her verbal reprimand, and she put that in the undisputed facts section, and it was a critical fact, and I guess that's what I'm driving at. But what I wanted to conclude with was the district court said circumstantial evidence can be suspicious, timing, ambiguous statements, behavior towards or comments directed at employees in the protected group, and other bits and pieces from which an inference of discriminatory intent might be drawn. And I think under that standard of circumstantial evidence and the new standard as set forth by Desert Palace, that we have clearly met that at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thanks to all counsel.